Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Offering a master's degree in clinical mental health counseling, work as a licensed professional counselor or mental health and wellness advocate. Details available at uwp.edu. This coming Monday, the 11th of January, the next installment in PBS's marvelous documentary series, American Experience, is going to be airing. And it is an amazing film called The Codebreaker. And it tells the story of an extraordinary woman who, until very, very recently, has been completely unknown to the general public. But she was actually somebody who figured prominently in our victory in the First World War, our victory in the Second World War, and also in the battle against organized crime during Prohibition. And as the title of the film suggests, the woman in question, Elizabeth Friedman, was someone who knew how to break codes. And this was certainly a matter of life and death, particularly in the Second World War. And much of the work that she did was done, in a sense, in secret, behind closed doors, highly classified activity, which has been almost completely unknown to the public until some of the files pertaining to her were finally declassified in 2008. That information, which came to light, inspired a book called The Woman Who Smashed Code. And that, in turn, is the primary inspiration for this marvelous film called The Codebreaker. And I feel very privileged indeed to be able to speak with the director and producer of this fine documentary, Shana Gazit. And again, this film, The Codebreaker, will air on PBS stations across the country, including Milwaukee's Channel 10, on Monday evening, January 11th. Shana Gazit, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much, and what a great summary of the film.
Good. Ahead of us talking about the film, I wonder if you could just say a word about your career as a documentarian and what, if anything, led you into this marvelous field.
Oh, I've been doing this for a while, and I have done a number of films for what you rightly called the wonderful series on PBS, American Experience. I think it's a very kind of unique series on the air. I love history, and this series was just a great avenue, outlet for someone who really likes to go and dig in behind stories that are both known and unknown. So I think that is, you know, being a documentary filmmaker is just an extraordinary privilege to be able to just really get into people's lives and experiences, and certainly with this one, with Elizabeth Friedman, wow, what a privilege to get to know her, so to speak.
Absolutely, and to share that story, her story, with the rest of us. By the way, what would be a couple of the other films that you have done for American Experience that some of our listeners might have seen?
They range from the Dust Bowl, Surviving the Dust Bowl, a Dust Bowl of the 1930s, to the pill, which was the development of the birth control pill. So the range has been wide. I did a film on the accident at Three Mile Island. I did a film on the huge flood of 1927 on the Mississippi Delta. So quite a variety of topics.
Wonderful. Well, this film, which I had the pleasure of watching last night, again titled The Codebreaker, is a really amazing story, which, as I mentioned in the introduction, has been almost completely unknown until very recently. Before we sort of tell the story, maybe you could say a word about how this story first came to light and how the author of The Woman Who Smashed Code, who appears in your film, was able to uncover this story and share it with the rest of us in the form of his book?
Well, Elizabeth Friedman really made it a point at the end of her life to archive as many, and I say as many of their material, because her husband was a code breaker as well. So it's really both of their work, whatever work that they were able to hold on to that wasn't classified, she archived and donated to the Marshall Library. And it's really there that that people started to go through that material and say, this is something really interesting here. There was also a historian at the ATF who also started to get a glimmer of there was this woman in the 1930s and 1920s and 30s fighting organized crime, and she became interested. So actually there was a push by a handful, really kind of turns out to be women, historians, to have the material declassified, which ultimately is what happened and allowed the author of the book to really spend his time going through the material and kind of piecing together her story.
Very good. I think one of the things that is intriguing about this general topic of breaking codes is that it is a complicated business, almost by its very nature. I mean, because, of course, the reason codes and ciphers are created is to make things too complicated to translate or discern. I'm just curious how much you and some of the others who assisted you with the film had to, in a sense, educate yourselves on this really complicated matter.
Oh, my goodness. It was really the hardest part of the film, is both getting some handle on what the process is of code breaking, and then figuring out how to give a taste of that in the film. Because I think that, you know, certain minds are kind of, you know, more easily take to code breaking than others. Mine does not. I don't have that kind of mental abilities that Elizabeth Friedman, of course, had. And so it really is quite it's quite hard to master. And the thing about Elizabeth and at times working with her husband is that they not only were master code breakers, but that they really invented the science of code breaking. That is, they brought mathematics and statistical analysis to a process of code breaking. So it really was creating kind of the modern science of code breaking is what they did. And that is, you know, that is something that we're still getting the benefits of today.
Right. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Shana Gazit, who is director and producer of the latest film in the American Experience documentary series on PBS, a film called The Code Breaker. And it tells the story of one Elizabeth Smith Friedman, who really broke new ground and had extraordinary skills when it came to the matter of code breaking, which ended up being a very much a matter of life and death during America's efforts in both of our world wars. Shana Gazit, one of the things I appreciate is that your film takes a little bit of time to introduce us to Elizabeth Smith, who eventually becomes Elizabeth Friedman. And you tell us a little bit about her background as a child, the large family that she came from, which in so many ways, first of all, sort of stands in contrast to who she ultimately grew up to be, but helps us really understand, in a sense, what propelled her into some really kind of uncharted fields. Tell us what you think is most important for our listeners to know about the early life of Elizabeth Smith.
Oh, she was just a little girl who just wanted a big life. She wanted, I think she was insatiably curious. She was incredibly energetic, and she just wanted to experience the world and to have a big life. And I think that's something that really propelled her from very early on, you know, through her career. The other thing that I think is really kind of remarkable about her early life is how she meets her husband, and then kind of the nature of their relationship. I mean, they meet in 1916, and, you know, that's, you know, 4 years before women are granted the right to vote. And it really is such a powerful relationship, and it's a relationship of equals, where they just get this enormous satisfaction and excitement from their intellectual relationship, and one in which they also bring, for them, code breaking is play. There's an element of fun to the process that she never gives up. It's always there for her. And so I think, you know, both her childhood and then and the marriage itself, I think, is something that is really fascinating. That was fascinating to me as well.
Right, I love the point made in your film that when people would address her as Miss Smith, as a young girl, that she just hated that, because in her mind there could be no plainer, more ordinary name than Miss Smith. And that was one of the things that fueled her to be something more than just one more Miss Smith in the world.
She did not want to be ordinary. She just really did not want to be ordinary.
Right.
Where does that come from?
Right. You tell us that she did manage to go to college after securing a loan from her father, who was hesitant, and she does become a teacher, but does not feel like that is the life meant for her, and quits after just a year. And on a trip to Chicago, she ends up visiting the Newberry Library and sees Shakespeare's first folio, which was proudly on display there. Tell us who she meets via the Newberry Library that, in a sense, sets so much of the next chapter of her life into motion.
It sets everything into motion, and she meets this very wealthy industrialist named George Fabian, who invites her to come to his estate called Riverbank. And George Fabian was this very kind of domineering and eccentric man who really created some sort of combination between probably the earliest think tank and a commune, commune only as far as that people, he gathers kind of some of the best minds and the best scientists to all live on this compound and to be the best that they can be. So there's a lot of science experimentation taking place, looking into genetics, looking into radio waves. You know, it's really a lot of kind of creative scientific exploration is taking place. But his pet project, probably the one he loved most, was this mission to prove what was his pet theory, and was actually quite a popular theory at the time, that Shakespeare did not write Shakespeare, that it was actually written by someone else. And the theory was that was written by the Elizabethan scientist and philosopher Francis Bacon. And the idea was that embedded in these very first printing of Shakespeare's work are actual codes. And if you can break the codes, what you would discover is that it was written by Francis Bacon and that he had embedded codes as to the real author in those folios. And that's what he assigned Elizabeth to do. Her job was to, you know, go through those, the folio with a fine-tooth comb, literally, and dig out the embedded codes.
Right. And these are, of course, embedded codes that we eventually learn aren't actually there. I mean, this is all, in a sense, a fruitless flight of fancy based on George Fabian's unfounded certainty that Shakespeare hadn't written his works, Francis Bacon had. But the fact that Elizabeth Smith, soon to be Elizabeth Friedman, undertakes this work and seems to enjoy it is really important. In fact, I think your film makes the point of saying that this was incredibly tedious work, yet work that she enjoyed because she had sort of a propensity for patience. And I think that's really interesting when we think about what it takes to be good at what she ultimately mastered, that the simple gift of patience might be one of the most crucial factors.
I agree. It's patience and, as I try to imagine it, just this intense ability to concentrate. You know, both qualities I do not have.
Me neither. And really importantly, this is not just where Elizabeth Smith Friedman first begins to learn about codes and breaking codes, so to speak, in working for this eccentric millionaire. But this is where she meets William Friedman, the man whom she ultimately marries. Tell us more about him and, in a sense, about the parallel track of their lives.
Well, I one of the things always to note about them is that, you know, she's this Quaker from the Midwest, and he's a Russian Jewish immigrant. So they couldn't come from more different backgrounds. And, you know, neither side of the family was too thrilled about them getting married. She meets William at Riverbank, that's George Fabian's estate, and he's there because he's a geneticist. He's doing research into plant genetics, but he's also an amateur photographer, and George Fabian asks him to photograph the Shakespeare folios and enlarge them so that it would be more easy, you know, to kind of go through it in its enlarged form. And that's really how they begin to work together. And that's how they begin to really kind of dabble in code breaking and to take an interest in code breaking. So it really comes as quite a shock to them when World War I breaks out and George Fabian decides that Riverbank will be the center of code breaking for the United States. And the reason that can happen is because America had very little code breaking capabilities. It was just not something that the Americans had really invested in. The Europeans actually had a much longer tradition of that. And so all of a sudden he says, that's it. You know, we are going to break codes for the military, and you, Elizabeth, and you, William, are in charge of this unit. So they were really kind of just thrown in,
right,
having really done nothing more than dabble, you know, in these Shakespeare folios.
Right. I really am glad that your film takes a moment to explain why code breaking was so critical in the First World War and why it was something that was, in a sense, kind of suddenly thrust upon our military and, of course, other militaries as well. And it really has to do with the emergence of a then brand new technology called radio.
Yes.
Explain why this is so significant, the emergence of radio during the First World War, how radio was being used and why it was so critical then to have codes and code breaking.
So because you could, transmit in this new, very, very effective medium, we have, of course, had the telegraph up to that point, but that was nothing compared to what the radios can do. So every sort of message was now really flying through the air, and both in terms of strategies on the battlefield and positioning really everything having to do with both the diplomatic and the military efforts of war was now being sent through the air. So of course since it can be sent through the air, it can be pulled easily from the air, and that's where encrypting the messages, encoding the messages, really comes into play.
Mm. It is at this point in your film that an explanation is given about the difference between codes and ciphers, and actually what we are talking about, for the most part, in terms of what Elizabeth Friedman worked on with such distinction, was the matter of ciphers, of actually changing letters, whereas a code is just substituting one word for another, and the person sending the code knows, and the receiver as well knows that when I say pumpkins, what I really mean is guns or whatever the substitution might be. Ciphering is something much more complex and much more difficult to decipher. Can you just say a word about just how complicated this gets and why Elizabeth Friedman was so good at untangling these ciphers?
So I guess the best example is actually something that we touch on in the film, which is that as you mentioned, in ciphers, you can, particular letters can turn into other letters, or could take into turn into numbers, or turn into symbols. And so, one of their most powerful tools is what they call the frequency charts. That is, they know in the English language, and this can be applied really to any language. And the amazing thing is that later on, Elizabeth is able to crack messages in all sorts of language. She can do it in Chinese, even though she doesn't speak Chinese. And she certainly does it in German during World War II. But once you understand what the most frequently used letters are in the English language or any language, then you can start by virtue of statistics, trying to figure out then, okay, if the letter Q shows up very, very often, chances are in English it's the letter E, which is the most commonly used letter in the English alphabet. So it's really taking a look at the whole alphabet through this kind of frequency analysis, and that's one of the very powerful tools that they use to begin to crack these codes, these messages.
Hmm. And it's amazing, of course, what she and others are able to accomplish. And she is responsible for helping to train what you call the first generation of code breakers that are working on this. Would you mind telling our listeners about one of the really most wonderful moments in the film, which they can see for themselves when they watch the film, namely a group photograph of some of these young men, I think it's mostly men, I think, that she is helping to train in the business of code breaking. This group photograph that really demonstrates Elizabeth Friedman's all-consuming love of and fascination with codes.
And pleasure and fun.
Yes.
That she has with codes. So she takes these group of trainees, and I never counted them in the photograph, but let's say there are, 40 of them. And when you look at the photograph, kind of on a second glimpse, you realize that some of their, and they're all dressed up in their, officer uniforms, and some of them are looking straight at the camera, which is what you would expect in a photograph, but some of them, and it's all kind of intermingled, are looking to the side. And so your first reaction is, well, what's this? This wasn't a very good photographer. He didn't get anybody to pay attention, as they should and be looking at the camera. But actually what it was is that they were, I guess, embedding or creating codes using people so that the people that are staring towards camera stand for one set of letters and the people that are staring off to the side represent another set of letters. And when you kind of put it all together, what it turns out to spell is knowledge is power. And knowledge and power is power was Francis Bacon had come up with that phrase, and I think that it really is something that very much they William and Elizabeth kept that photograph for the duration of their life. And actually, William Friedman had it on his table, on his desk, until the day he died. So there's something about knowledge is power. There's something about the level of kind of sheer enjoyment that they got from code breaking. And the fact that this really was the beginning of an era, beginning of the science of code breaking, that somehow all is in that one photograph.
This is, of course, an extraordinary accomplishment for a woman at that point in time. I mean, when so many doors were closed to women, Elizabeth Friedman is doing this tremendously valuable work. And then in the next instance, see a door being slammed shut, and that is when William, her husband, signs up for field work as a code breaker. That is not back here in America, but in Europe, in a sense, on the battlefield or close to the battlefields. And this is something that is absolutely not possible for Elizabeth to do. And I'm so glad that the point is made that, I mean, it reminds us of what Elizabeth Friedman is accomplishing at a point in time when she's not perhaps even able to cast a vote in a presidential election.
Right.
It is another era for women.
I think there was a lot of, clearly in her career, she was up against this all the time. And there was really, especially in the earlier years, a sense that, William, her husband, he's the real code breaker, and, she's kind of second best, or he's really doing the work, and she's just kind of, riding that wave. And in fact, William Friedman was an extraordinarily important and gifted code breaker, but so was she. And in I think it was particularly painful in World War I because she had trained William. So, and for him going to Europe to be a field code breaker was not only serving his country, which was important to both of them, but it really meant that there was a career path ahead of him where there was none for Elizabeth.
We are speaking with Shana Gazit, who is the director and producer of this American Experience documentary that airs on January 11th, titled The Codebreaker. And it tells primarily the story of Elizabeth Smith Friedman, this extraordinarily gifted and skilled codebreaker, and the exploits of her husband, William, as well. It is not just during wartime that this work as a codebreaker is of value, but also in the years after the First World War, the 20s and the 30s, which is at least part of it, the era of prohibition. And Elizabeth Friedman, who is busy for a time raising two young children, becomes pulled into the matter of code breaking once again. Explain why code breaking, of all things, was important at this point in time, which in which we were not at war, and so codes were not being used in that sort of way from with enemy states.
So it's really prohibition gives rise to organized crime that you know we have come to know. I mean, it's the kind of the black market in liquor just became hugely sophisticated and hugely profitable, and the level of kind of business acumen that it took in order to coordinate the volume of shipments that were coming into the country, because they were coming in by sea. And so they would be these, what were called these motherships, which were these huge ships that held, you know, kind of tons and tons of alcohol. And then there would be these black ships that would come with the smaller ships and would take it to shore. So in order to do that level of coordination and to evade the Coast Guard, they started using codes. And the codes became, and radio, of course, they had their kind of radio stations throughout. And the codes became more and more sophisticated, and a lot of times these syndicates would hire former World War I code makers, so that when Elizabeth starts cracking these codes, she's cracking codes that are as sophisticated, if not more so, and at some point it is more so, than what she was doing in World War I. So the ability to really, you know, it's during this period where she really essentially invents a whole new system for law enforcement that we again kind of take for granted. I mean, what she does, I always think of that scene in the HBO series Homeland.
Yes.
Where that character has this whole wall, and she puts up, you know, all the important pieces of information and all the key players, and begins to connect the dots. Well, that's what Elizabeth essentially invents.
Right. So in other words, she's not just breaking these codes, not just translating these messages, which are number in the thousands, maybe the tens of thousands, but that she is also then going one step further and explaining the significance of these messages. I'm sure in many cases these are almost like the kind of message you might receive in a telegram. I mean, not that these were telegrams, but I mean, they would be, I mean...
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
It really is pretty extraordinary. It's really extraordinary that that she had kind of the courage to do it, because, you know, she was dealing with the likes of Al Capone. She was going up against the likes of the, you know, kind of the greatest gangsters of all time, and going on the witness stand and testifying against them. So, you know, they had hits out on her. I mean, it was a dangerous thing to do, and it didn't stop her.
Mm.
She really kind of made light of it.
Right.
But there she was.
And I think one thing she ended up also doing that I'm glad your film tells us a bit about is that there were instances in which a defense attorney defending one of these organized crime figures might try to draw a veil of suspicion around the kind of code breaking that Elizabeth Friedman was doing, characterizing it almost like witchcraft or,
yeah,
or tarot
yeah.
card reading or
yeah, you know, exactly.
something. And of course, what ends up then being a stern challenge for her is to explain, to lay it out very, very clearly exactly what she was doing as a code breaker. You tell us of at least one instance in which she asked for a blackboard to be brought into the courtroom so she could spell it out exactly for everybody present just how real this science of code breaking was.
And, you know, they're not only the lawyers who are defending the mobsters at this point. You know, they're not only going after the fact that, you know, what is this? This is, you know, this is nonsense, really. But also it's this kind of this, you know, a diminutive woman, you know, who's now taking the stand. So they're really trying to belittle her on all levels.
Mm.
And so that when she asked the judge for a blackboard, which was kind of a very unorthodox thing to do, and they bring it in and she begins to give a lesson in code breaking, I mean, it's kind of there was a gasp in the courtroom, because she did it so well and so effectively, and and she so knew what she was doing.
Right. Well, your film, of course, in a sense, climaxes with the very dramatic work that she does during the Second World War. And one of the things you tell us, and again, this brings us back to the unhappy reality of certain doors being very much slammed in the face of a woman, even one as gifted and skilled as Elizabeth Friedman, is the fact that when the military begins to put together programs for code breaking, it just was not possible for a woman to be in charge of men in a scenario
yep.
like that. So explain the role that Elizabeth Friedman ultimately did play in terms of code breaking during the Second World War.
So she had been working for the Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard at a certain point was understood that her work was so vital to what they were doing is that they did create a unit, and they allowed her to hire some people, and they put her in charge of the unit. But when the war breaks out, the Navy takes over the Coast Guard, and now it's no longer possible for a woman to be in charge of the unit. So they actually assigned someone that she had trained, who I'm sure was very nice and very good, but certainly was her junior in terms of capabilities. And he now is in charge of the unit, and she works for him. And the work that she's doing as she starts breaking the codes in this particular unit is that she is realizing that there is this really extensive Nazi spy network in South America. It's kind of part of World War II that I don't think I knew very much about before. And what these this Nazi spy ring is doing is gathering information in the Western Hemisphere and is sending So what was happening was that this was at the beginning of the war, there was the Battle of the Atlantic, which means that the Germans were sending out U-boats, submarines, to bring down the Allies' supply ships and also ships carrying soldiers to the battlefield. And this was absolutely threatening the survival of the Allies, especially England, who was really dependent on these supplies. And what she's realizing with this is that the Nazi spy ring is actually giving the locations of the Allied supply ships to the U-boats, to the German high command, who then kind of communicates that to the U-boats. And so that's an incredibly critical thing that she's doing, because had the U-boats continued to be as effective as they had been, really the war would have been lost. And we're talking, you know, 1941, 1942. And by virtue of her ability to crack those codes, then she can really then send information to Allied shipping saying, avoid this area, take evasive maneuver here, and really starts being able to, you know, give the Allies, you know, some ability to deal with the Nazi U-boat attacks. So it's an incredibly important work that she's doing. The other reason to focus on the Nazi spy ring is that there was real concern. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt talked about it in one of his speeches. There was a real concern that somehow the Nazis were going to be able to pull the South American countries into their fold. And all of a sudden, you now would have a kind of a third front for the United States to deal with, you know, in South America, which, again, would have been absolutely devastating. So her ability to understand what was happening in South America, what the spy ring was doing, was just really critical. And eventually what she's able to do is to destroy the network. She gets so inside of what they're doing that she's really able to kind of outflank their every move, and is able to destroy the network. And at that point, I mean, you had coups happening in South America that were sympathetic to the Nazi cause. Also, you had a tremendous amount of Nazi activity in South America, and you had Nazi rallies. So it's really an extraordinary thing. It's what we really don't hear about is how important or how dangerous the world was in South America, and therefore how important her work was in kind of destroying that network.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, one J. Edgar Hoover ends up, in a sense, taking credit for all that Elizabeth Friedman accomplished. And you tell us that a very thick veil of secrecy surrounded all of the work that she had done until well after her death in 1980. And so it is only now that the general public is coming to understand all that she accomplished. In our last minute or two, I want to give you just a moment to talk about one other aspect of your film and of Elizabeth Friedman's story that I think is so notable, and that is the fact that on top of being this incredibly gifted and hard-working, dedicated codebreaker, she is also a very dedicated wife and so supportive of her husband, William, after he suffers a nervous breakdown and, in a sense, is never the same man after that. I get the sense that it was really important to you as the filmmaker to tell this part of the story. I mean, you don't glance over it with just a sentence or two, but really are careful to tell this part of the story thoroughly. Why was this so important to you?
It was, and you're absolutely right. It was important. I mean, partly I think because I was just so moved by it. But it was important because it was an extraordinary marriage. As I mentioned earlier, it was really a marriage of equals and a marriage in which they just really supported each other completely. So, you know, being able to witness that marriage was important to me. But also, I think that it speaks to who she is. I mean, she is a woman. She is a human being. And so she is doing the most important work one can imagine in terms of the survival of the country. But yet at the same time, she's still going home. And she still has a house to run. And she still has children. And she still has a marriage with now her husband who is ailing. And her ability to carry all of it, I think, is what makes her even more extraordinary. It wasn't just kind of the work that was extraordinary. Her humanity was extraordinary. And kind of just, we all carry, kind of our personal lives and our professional lives. And boy, she had her share to carry. And so I was just I was filled with a lot of admiration for her as really kind of a woman and a human being.
Rightly so. The film, again, is titled The Codebreaker, and it airs on Monday, January 11th on the PBS series American Experience on PBS stations across the country, including Milwaukee Channel 10. The director and producer of the film, Shana Gazit. Shana Gazit, congratulations on a marvelous film. And thank you for being part of the morning show today. It was great to talk with you.
Thank you so much, really. And thank you for taking such an interest.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, author Tim Caulfield and his marvelous, fascinating new book called Your Day, Your Way, in which he examines many of the decisions that we make through the course of a simple day and explores some of the fact and fiction behind some of those choices, like getting on a bathroom scale or brushing one's teeth. It's a really fascinating book, and we will explore it on tomorrow's morning show. On Friday, we're scheduled to speak with Angela Zimmerman, the new director of the Racine Public Library. It's exactly 9 o'clock. Support for